Let me begin by saying how delighted I am being invited to take part once again in this great endeavor. The Scientific and Medical Network and the Mystics and Science Conference. I would like to thank Dr. Peter Fenwick and David Lorimer for their warm welcome and pay tribute to them for having created such a dynamic, important and imaginative organization out of the network. I remember one of the founders, George Blaker, with the greatest of fondness. I think that normally I speak just directly, spontaneously, but then it will go on for 3 hours. Since there's a time constraint here, I will restrict to this very boring text here for you. I'm just teasing you. No, I'm just. In fact, what I've brought here is the essence. And in fact, that's one of the reasons is first, you were requesting whether you could have the tape of this. I said, maybe not. Because it contains the highest teachings, which you will get one shot. And so I am sharing with you something of the highest of my tradition. Since many of you are really, very learned and very curious and very, I think, well-informed. So I think we can safely do that. I think that we all understand how vital. First of all, can you hear me clearly? Okay. And the sound is good? I think that we all understand how vital it is to further our understanding of consciousness and the mind, and what revolutionary change it can make to each one of us, personally, and to the whole of a society, especially given the challenges of our time. The Buddhist teachings offer an extraordinary understanding of mind, and a complete methodology for working with the mastery of our minds and its emotions. Many people have called Buddhism a science of mind. We must have all heard of the statement made by Einstein, in which he said, "The religion of the future will be a cosmic religion, a religion which is based on experience, which refuses to be dogmatic. If there is any religion that would cope with the scientific needs of the future, it would be Buddhism." The teaching of Buddha is very practical and it's directed at freeing us from suffering. And if you look, the predominant kind of suffering in the developed countries of the world, especially in the West today, is caused by problems of the mind, such as anxiety, depression, anger, cynicism, all these lovely words, fear, frustration, loneliness, a lack of self-worth, so on. But because they originate in the mind, these problems can only be tackled by working with the mind itself, through contemplation, analysis, getting to the very root of suffering, so that it can no longer disturb our peace of mind. A good news is that this is possible. For as a great Tibetan teacher of the mind training once remarked that one of the mind's most marvelous quality is that it can be transformed. It's clear? And over recent years, His Holiness Dalai Lama has been encouraging an ongoing dialogue between scientists and Buddhism. What are his reasons? The goal here is to increase our understanding of the world, of mind, of consciousness, and of emotions. And one of the outcomes has been a number of experiments, for example, in America, on experienced Buddhist meditation practitioners. Many of the lamas, actually, I know them, you see. These have roused tremendous interest in popular press. For example, in Time Magazine, the Financial Times, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the National Geography Magazine, so on. And the thing is, the tests were carried out on practitioners with up to 40,000 hours of meditation experience and involve different kinds of meditation practices, and they show a remarkable range of results, such as an unusually high level of activity in the parts of brain that help to form positive emotions, such as happiness, enthusiasm, joy, and self-control. In fact, what they found at these parts of the brain are, you see, I think you know that, you see, in generally what we call the musical brain, isn't it? And in the case of musicians who play violin, for example, like to 10,000 distinct, the finger that's connected to the brain, is there's a, seen to be a remarkable change. But what is amazing now with the scientists is that, you know, there's like a, you know, finger that connect with the brain, when the movement of the finger affects, you see, the brain. But then what has been amazing now with this research is that actually the mind can transform mind. Do you understand? Thought point transformation. This has been the new and exciting kind of result of these findings, which show that in the case of these experienced practitioners, the parts of the brain that form positive emotions such as happiness, joy, they are lit up. And not only, what is interesting, is not only lit up when they're practicing, but also when they were not practicing, which is quite remarkable. And that the, and also decrease level of the activity of the parts of brain related to the negative emotions, such as depression, self-centeredness, and lack of happiness and satisfaction. Those are down. And also calming of regions of the brain that act as a trigger for fear and anger. And also what they found was that they have an incredible ability to maintain a state of inner peace even when facing extremely disturbing circumstances. And what they found to be also very, were very excited about was that an unusual capacity these experienced practitioners had for empathy and for attunement to other people's emotions. And also it is interesting that when practitioners meditate on non-referential or all-pervasive compassion, the regions of the brain that are responsible for planned action were activated, as they are poised and ready to go to the aid of those in distress. Because previously sometimes it was felt that the meditation is something a little bit selfish, and you're just meditating. I remember when I first came to teach, why don't you do something for the benefit of others? But it's been discovered that through real, genuine practice of training with the mind and meditation, actually really unleashes the compassion. You understand? I'm not going to explain very much. Normally when I speak directly, I explain, but I would just kind of, because of the constraint of time. These findings seem to show that the training of the mind can have an extremely significant impact and on the function of the brain. It appears that emotional tendencies can be altered and destructive emotions can be lessened. Now, talking of the mind, you see that the teaching of the Buddha, there was also a question very much related to the mind, which I include in this, that the teaching of Buddha say that the destructive emotions can be transformed and even eliminated by training the mind. Why? Because they are not intrinsic to our mind. In fact, Buddhism goes further to say, or to show us, that the innermost nature of mind is clear light, a pure, pristine awareness, free from all mental affliction whatsoever. If you look at the mind, we find that, in fact, the mind is the root of everything. You see, it's the creator of happiness, the creator of suffering, creator of what we call samsara, and creator of what we call nirvana. In Tibetan teachings, the mind is often known as the kunjie gyapo, which means like a king who's responsible for everything. But since kind of there is no such king these days, so my modern translation would be, mind is the universal ordering principle, the creator of happiness, creator of suffering, creator of samsara, and creator of what we call nirvana. But you see, the thing again is the trouble with the mind is that most people think that mind is being just thoughts and emotions. When you say what mind is, they think of thoughts and emotions as being mind. But these are, in fact, actually just the appearance of mind and not the true nature of mind itself. In fact, the mind has two aspects, as the appearance aspect of mind and the essence and the nature of mind. You understand? We spend most of our lives lost in the appearance of mind without any understanding of the nature of mind. We are always looking for our true nature outside of ourselves. You see? In our thoughts, emotions. In fact, there's a wonderful saying, like keeping the elephant at home but looking for its footprints in the forest. Something like that. We are looking in the wrong direction, as if we were facing the west and expecting to for the sun to rise. Or, as the famous saying, as I mentioned, leaving the elephant at home and looking for its foot in the forest. The direction which we look is crucial, but because the way we look is the way we see. In fact, one great master put it that the samsara is mind turned outwardly, lost in its projection, whereas nirvana is mind turned inwardly, recognizing its nature. We give so much importance to these appearances, the projection of the mind. Whatever thoughts, emotions rise, we let them sweep us away, off into a spiral of stories and illusions, which we take so seriously that we end up not only believing, but becoming as well. As the great master in the, I think maybe some of you may have heard of Milarepa, some of you. His teacher is called Marpa. Marpa's teacher is called Naropa. He was a great Indian pandit. And then his teacher was the great saint called Telopa, the first human master in the lineage of what's called Mahamudra. In the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, two great lineages called Mahamudra and the Dzogchen are the highest teachings. This great master Telopa, in his hard advice to Naropa, said, "Son, it is not the appearance that bind us. Punnawema chinzimbeti." By the way, that's in Tibetan. Right. The bit that you didn't understand. Punnawema chinzimbeti. It's not the appearance that bind us, but it's a mind, the grasping. So it's the abandoned grasping. The problem is not the appearance. The problem is the mind that clings and grasps. It is not the appearance themselves that are the problems. It is how the mind perceives them, grasps at them, and tries to solidify them as if they were real. Even Shakespeare says, "There is nothing either good or bad, but thinking makes it so." And Buddha, in his very famous teaching, he said, "We are what we think." Of course, Californians say we are what we eat. But a little bit more fundamental is that we are what we think. All that we are rise with the thoughts. With the thoughts, we make the world. Speak or act with pure mind and happiness will follow. We are what we think. All that we are rise with the thoughts. With the thoughts, we make the world. Speak or act with evil mind and trouble will follow as shadow unshakable. In fact, if you really look into it, mind is like a crystal. It's really pure and pristine, primordially pure. That's why Shakespeare said also, nothing is good or bad, ultimately thinking makes it so. The mind is like a crystal. And it adopts whatever color, whatever surface you place it on. The mind will become just whatever you allow to occupy. That's why Buddha said, we are what we think. In fact, William James, the great American psychologist, and philosopher said that each of us literally chooses by his way of attending to things what sort of universe he shall appear to himself to inhabit. So we make the world of us a world that we enjoy or world that we suffer in the world of karmic phenomena fashioned by our thoughts and emotions. And if we're able to change the one who makes it actually, then naturally our world will change. Or to put it more simply, if he conquer the mind. I remember Dalai Lama often says, you see, when people ask how to be happy, what is the art of happiness? I've often heard him say that, you see, granted that external situations and circumstances to a certain extent contribute to one's happiness, suffering, but fundamentally happiness, suffering depend upon the mind. That is to say, how the mind perceives through the five senses. Is that clear? And that's one of the reasons why in the Buddhist teachings, the most important thing. Like I remember Dalai Lama saying, particularly this recently very much, in the last few years, he emphasized very much, that is to say, the Buddhism is not about rituals, not about ceremonies, not about yoga, even not about meditation also, not about mantras, even though these are part of Buddhism, aspect of Buddhism. But fundamentally, Buddhism is about transforming the mind. In fact, when Buddha was asked, because one way the teaching Buddha is extraordinarily vast, what Buddha spoke alone is 108 volumes. If you have I always tease people saying, if Tibet get independent, we have Tibetan hotels and try to have Buddhist Bibles, the half of the room will be occupied. It's huge. But yet, what is amazing is that it can be all essentialized. When he was asked what the essence of his teaching, he said, commit not a single unwholesome action. Cultivate the wealth of virtue. To tame this mind of ours, this is the teaching Buddha. Which when you really explain very simply, is first it means is that commit not a single unwholesome action. When you ask, how can I possibly not commit a single unwholesome action? You might ask. What it really means is as much as possible, abandon all the unwholesome, negative and harmful actions which are the cause of suffering for ourselves and others. On the other hand, cultivate the wealth of virtue is the adopt all the positive, wholesome, beneficial actions which are the cause of happiness for ourselves and others. That is to say, if you don't want suffering, then abandon the cause of suffering, which is negative, which is ignorance, negative emotion, negative action, which is good. Whereas if you want happiness, then engage in beneficial, altruistic, beneficial actions. You understand? As one great master put it, great saint, great bodhisattva, he said, all the happiness there is in this world comes from thinking of others. All the suffering there is in this world comes from only our selfishness, very much. So very much you see that if you, that is the first thing. But the most important point that I wanted to really emphasize is the third line. He says, Rang Sem Nyon Sundu, that's in Tibetan, which means tame this mind of ours, which means to transform this mind of ours. Because as Dalai Lama said, Buddhism is about transforming the mind. You understand? Transforming the mind. Because if you transform the mind, if you conquer the mind, then you conquer your perception and your experience, whereby even the appearance and circumstance will change. So that's why the problem is not appearance. The problem is very much how our own perception and experience is. So that if we conquer the mind, then we conquer the perception and experience thereby. And particularly so when you talk about happiness and contentment, there are two kinds of happiness. One is based on more material comfort and pleasure. Others based on deeper mental contentment. If you have deeper mental contentment, then even though you may experience more kind of, those with really deeper mental, this shows that people who actually have all the material advantage, but yet if they do not have the contentment, they're not really quite happy. They're not really, I remember Dalai Lama saying that people who live in the 100th floor of the highest skyscraper in New York, maybe in the overlooking the Central Park West. You might have this incredible apartment, but you'd be probably, if your mind is kind of, messed up, you're probably looking for a window to jump out. Whereas if you have deeper mental happiness or contentment, then even though we may experience physical or difficulties, but we're still happy. Is that clear? So nowadays, but now I'm going deeper and deeper and deeper. Nowadays, so many people seem to be asking the truth about ourselves, asking, who am I? Okay, first I say about generally about the mind, the importance of transforming the mind. Okay? Now we come a little bit deeper, next level. We change the gear now. Nowadays, so many people seem to be seeking the truth about themselves, asking, who Who am I? A yearning to realize their true selves beyond the ego self. Are we just the thoughts, emotions, our stories? Is that all that we amount to? Are all these things that we identify ourselves really us? If we stop and have a good look, we will see that every single thing that we normally associate with ourselves is always in the process of change. Our thoughts are always changing, our emotions are always changing, our stories are always changing. We are not who we were yesterday, nor who we will be tomorrow. We are not who we were in our childhood, or nor who we will be in our old age. If we look at the past thoughts, if you look at the mind also, the thoughts also, if you look at the past thoughts, you will find that you have missed them, or you have missed it. The past thought is past, gone. It is already gone. If you look into the future thoughts, you cannot find it because it has not yet risen. Even the present moment, as soon as we start to think about it, it has slipped away. A great Tibetan master, Thingpo Khyentse Rinpoche, always used, he was the teacher of the Dalai Lama, he often used to say, you see, that you can never have a thought in the present. That is to say, past thought has vanished. There's nothing left of them. The future thought yet not yet risen. Now, in no way that even the present thought exists by themselves without depending on that. This is not very clear, if I say more directly. Is that the past thought has ceased, the future thought yet not yet come. As regards the present, the moment you start thinking, it's already past. Because when you have a thought, it must have an object. Subject, object. As long as the object, the first thought, is already past. Do you understand? So you cannot have a thought in the present moment. So all these are illusory. So when we really break it down, there is actually nothing that we could hold on to and say, this is my mind. And so who are we really? What is really us? You see, what is that is constant and that is unchanging? What is that fundamental true nature mind, a being? In fact, what I am kind of, unfortunately, because of the constraint of time, I'm kind of summing up something which normally need to be presented over like several hours to really, you understand it. But then I hope you get it. Which is that, you see, then you were saying, okay, if all these are not really us, then who are we really? What is really us that is constant and unchanging? What is the fundamental true nature of a mind or being, if you'd ask? Then here, from the morning when we woke up or wake up, now while we are listening to this, tonight until you go to bed, you will have lived with an awareness, a clear, knowing kind of consciousness. During the day, you might have got upset or angry or excited or sad or expectant or afraid or bored. Particularly you are now bored. And many of you have gone to sleep already. I'll wake you up when I'm finished. As you say, I remember doing a conference about the survival consciousness, that consciousness does not survive after lunch. And so, you see, so but while your moods and feelings might have changed, the continuity of a clear, vivid awareness was always there, whatever you were experiencing. A clear awareness of cognizance, a knowing quality of mind, dwells in a fundamental mind stream. It is our minds at its purest and most fundamental level. But we should not make a mistake of thinking it is some kind of an entity that exists as something solid, substantial, or independent. It is constant and changing, but it's not permanent. This awareness has always been with us, will always be with us throughout our lives. And this is who or what we really are. When you come to the deepest understanding of the clear awareness, It can be called in the Buddhist teachings the Buddha nature, or the innermost nature mind, as the Dalai Lama says, that this consciousness is the innermost subtle mind. We call it the Buddha nature, the real source of our consciousness. The continuum of this mind lasts even through Buddhahood. I think maybe I need to speak directly, unfortunately. It's like this, you see. There are two aspects of mind. There's one aspect of mind that's always changing, you see, and constantly dying. You understand? You see? If you rely on that, that's not reliable. So if you grasp, have attachment on the domain of that, you know, then. But what the really the how do you say, the practitioner, spiritual practitioners, look to, or the wise man, is not, you see, as we said, that the samsara is mind turned outwardly lost in its projection. Nirvana is mind turned outwardly, you know. You see, I think even though, because I was bringing many, many points, but then I think, you know, that just will put you to sleep. I think the main thing is to get to some main points, the main crucial points, on which the entire meaning of life and death depends. Clear? So the first thing is the problem with us is with our mind and our consciousness. Generally, the mind is defined in the Buddhist teaching as awake, no, conscious, cognizant and awake. That's the definition of mind. And you can simply say that really the quality of mind is to know. You know? Know. 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 Not N-O-W, but K-N-W, know. But unfortunately, the ego has misused the knowing mind to grasp. So the whole point of the spiritual path is to free the mind from its grasping and to return to pure knowing. Is that clear? Now, what has happened now at the moment is that, you see, our mind is turned outwardly. I think you got that, isn't it? The samsara is mind turned outwardly, lost in its projection. That is to say, when we talk about the mind in the West, people think of, you see, thoughts and emotion, the mind. That's not the mind. Like when you talk about the sun and the rays. Rays are not the sun, even they come from the sun. Is that clear? So very much, you see, the problem with us is we, when we investigate and search to try to understand the mind, we chase after thoughts and emotions, which means we go further and further from ourselves. It's like you send somebody to look for somebody, and both of them are clueless. And go and chase, have no idea. So you chase after thoughts, emotions. You will never come to the root of it. Is that clear? The root of it. That's why at the moment, the reason why in the state of delusion or suffering is because mind turned outwardly lost in projections. Like for example, we do a lot. We speak a lot. We think a lot. But we have no idea of the actor, or no idea of the speaker, no idea of the thinker, or the stinker. Understand? We have no awareness of ourselves. Our mind is always turned outwardly lost. I often say we're all like fragmented, scattered all over, that in fact nobody, I just say, nobody's at home. So we miss ourselves very much. That's why what the teachings speak of, that this samsara is mind turned outwardly lost in its projection. Whereas nirvana, which is the state of liberation. I don't know. I assume that you know what samsara is. Yeah. Samsara is the state of delusion. It's because of ignorance, negative emotion, and negative action. You see, it's only like, how do you say, it's like we want happiness, but we go for suffering. As one great master saint, he said, the longing to be happy, in their ignorance,
They destroy their own happiness as if it were their worst enemy. That's samsara. Though they wish to get rid of suffering, but yet they rush headlong towards it. That's suffering. So then, how do we then, you see, but where is the solution? Where is the liberation? Where can we bring about the cessation of suffering? That is, I said, the mind turned outwardly, mind turned inwardly, recognize true nature. That is to say, mind turned inwardly doesn't mean just mind again turn and become very introvert. That's not the solution either. But what it really means is that instead of projecting, like for example, when you project a film or something, if you stop the projection or the projector, then all the projection dissolves. So the main thing is to stop the projection. In fact, in the teaching on the Tibetan Book of the Dead and the Tibetan Book of Living Dying, which I think many people seem to have read, in that particularly chapter on this life, the most important and best way to prepare for death is actually to prepare while we are alive, you see. So the most important, really, the work, it is said in the teaching, the task that we have to do in this life is to work with our mind and its projections, to purify our projection and realize its essence, its true nature, which if you really look in a deeper sense, it's a bit like the realizing of the Trinity in us. In Buddhism, we call it the essence of mind, the nature of mind, the compassion of mind. The essence of mind is like the God the Father. The nature of mind is like the Holy Ghost. And the compassion is like the Son. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Ghost. Amen. It is within. God is not outside, but within. It is the ignorant that separate us, because there was a question about why we are split up. Also, split comes actually from ignorance. From the moment in the Buddhist teachings, you see, one very important point is that in the Buddhist teaching, the fundamental view is that now you can have the tape of this teaching. It's okay, because it's a bit rubbish. No, but because the very highest point that I wanted to share because of the, how do you say, because of the constraint of time, I think. So if you like, you can have the tape of this to everyone. So where were we? At the highest point. And before that? The Trinity. What I want to say, that the most important point in the Buddhist teachings is that regardless who we are, we all have the Buddha nature. The potential of enlightenment. In fact, there's a saying, one ground, two paths. One ground means on the fundamental nature, there's not the slightest difference between Buddhas and us. But whereas on the relative level, what has happened is Buddhas recognized nature, became enlightened, whereas we did not recognize the nature and became confused. In fact, we can say that confusion is a bit like, you see, is in that state of ignorance. It is when the ignorance began, that's where the delusion started. The ignorance, something like if you were involved in an accident and we had an amnesia, you know, we are still we, but we do not know who the hell we are. That kind of moment when we are kind of completely lost in that state of ignorance, then you see, you desperately, first thing that comes is fear. Fear and then grasping. And then you desperately, you look for an identity. And then you try to grasp onto something. And thus became the false view of self or the ego started. You understand? And as there's ego, as there's I, then there is the other. Then subject, object. And so therefore, the negative emotions began. Because if there was no I and other, there would be no jealousy, no anger. Isn't it? In fact, in a sense, in the Christian sense, if you would say, the story of the, how you say, the Adam's, the apple, the wrong apple that Adam ate. You know that. And then from the tree of knowledge, then the, what you say, he became a fallen angel. That's where the split became. The split became in the ignorance and the delusion. Is that clear? All right, because that was the question that was there. So the main thing is now coming back to the main point that the samsara is mind turned outwardly lost in its projection, whereas nirvana is mind turned inwardly recognized nature. mind and inwardly is not lost in its projection. It's that instead of projecting, instead of like if you stop the projection, that the moment you stop, like the projector, all the projection dissolve. In fact, if I were to share very directly with you, something I heard over 30 years ago from a very great master, two lines. For me, these two lines really spoke to the heart of what the essence and the nature of mind is in its fundamental, in its primordial, in its absolute kind of sense. And that how to then abide by, how to remain in this, which is the meditation at the highest level. For me, these two lines were extraordinarily helpful. It was really kind of, for me, it was kind of revolutionary. And I shared it with you, which is that in Tibetan, it's very beautiful. It says, Chu manyuk na tang sem ma chuna de. You got it? Chu is water. Okay? Manyuk is if you don't stir it. Na tang means will be clear. That means water, if you don't stir it, will become clear. Isn't it? Now, because we don't have so much time, in a short time, I'm trying to show something fundamental, the essence and nature of mind, but also something experiential in a short time, which is two lines, which is that water, if you don't stir it, will become clear. That's the first time, chumanyuntam. In the same manner, sem machunadim. Sem means mind. Machu is a very beautiful Tibetan word, which means unaltered. Unaltered. You see, mind unaltered, because the trouble with us, we always alter mind. We manipulate mind. We fabricate mind, particularly through too much thinking. That's why there's a very famous saying, no brain, no pain. That's not from Buddhism, by the way, but anyway. But yet, is that what happens is this, you see, as I was saying to you, mind, unfortunately, many authorities on mental health have often said that the root cause of all a mental problem is actually too much thinking. So it's that we don't allow our mind to be. In fact, the French philosopher Pascal said, he said the difficulty, what was the quote directly, Patrick? All men's difficulty. He's my reference. All of men's difficulty stem from the fact of his inability to sit quietly in a room by himself. All of men's difficulties in the Bible. Yeah. And because of that, then we lost the contentment. We don't know how to be because we're always looking outwardly for entertainment, for confirmation of self. We've really lost home. We lost our self, knowledge of self. Therefore, we lost contentment. Is that correct? And so, just as water, if you don't stir it, it becomes clear. In the same manner, mind left unaltered. Instead of manipulating and fabricating, if you leave your mind in its own nature, you see, this is very beautiful. Like when you leave your mind just unaltered, unaltered, that means live in the natural, it's primordial, in the state of natural great peace. When you leave your mind in the unaltered state, if you allow your mind be, you see, then what happens? Slowly the confusion or all the projections and thoughts slowly settle. Just as if you don't stir the water, it'll become clear. You understand? It's a very simple thing that you can do. This image is quite evocative. Just as water, if you don't stir it, will become clear. In the same manner, the essence and the nature of mind is such that if you do not alter, and if you just allow the mind to be, this actually is meditation at the highest level. So far, where are we? Mind left unaltered. Unaltered, that means this beautiful word unaltered is when you leave it in its own nature. Just unaltered, just quietly, you see. Will find its true peace. It says, Sem Machinde, they will find the peace, the well-being, the happiness and bliss.
The key thing lies in just allowing a mind just quietly to be in its true nature. Like sometimes you see when the great masters, because there is a tradition in Buddhism, particularly in the Tibetan tradition, the highest transmissions, highest communication of wisdom happens when a great master in his meditation, from his wisdom and compassion, when he kind of directs his mind and then says to a student who has the openness of heart and mind, of devotion, and says that like just as water, if you don't stir it, will become clear. In the same manner, mind left unaltered will experience the bliss. And then master will stay actually in that state, in the nature of mind, in the state of enlightenment. You understand? And when you communicate it, the atmosphere is quite extraordinary. It can completely disarm your mind and all your thoughts are freed. And then you become like the sky. All the thoughts, emotions are freed, and you discover the sky-like nature of your mind. And that from the sky-like nature of mind shines forth your own true nature, or the Buddha nature, like the sun. The sun has two wonderful qualities. There's a tremendous light and brilliance, and there's a tremendous warmth. In fact, the light is like the wisdom. The warmth is the love and compassion. When you uncover your mind in its original pure nature, what you discover is wisdom and compassion. You understand? If you ask, what is the mind of the Buddha? It's wisdom and compassion. You get it? Now, then we came back to this point about who are we? Remember, I started, so I have to finish it, unfortunately. Who are we? You see, are we the thoughts, emotions? Are we the stories? Are we all this? We really examine. That you find these are always constantly changing anyway. Unfortunately, because we always associate with ourselves, with our thoughts, emotions, that's why sometimes what happens, when we have a good thought, we're happy. When we have a bad thought, we're unhappy. And so much so that we beat ourselves. I think one of the biggest problems in the West is, you see, if I may speak very directly, that there's a problem at the core being. Core being? Core being. A kind of a wounded love. There is that unconditional being is not there. Like, for example, in Tibet, it's interesting. People might be a little bit thick here. Thick here. Not very educated. But here at the heart level, there's a kind of knowledge, a kind of, that know how to take care of them, how not to beat yourself. Like, for example, when we came first to the West, in fact, Dalai Lama was very startled when people said that in the West, people hate themselves. You know, he was really amazed by this. In fact, I remember I was there at that moment that even though there was a translator, he understood English quite well. He asked the translator, what does it mean? So it was really the notion of that self-hate was something that, foreign. Because in the sense that what you do, you love yourself, not you hate yourself. You not beat yourself. You be your friend, not your enemy. But sometimes that, the mind is really developed very, very high, but then the heart is very like a baby. And even in the spiritual practice also, sometimes you have a lot of knowledge, but somehow you're not able to translate that in terms of experience on the level of heart. You understand? That's where. But the main thing is, that's one of the reasons why, even if you hear very high and profound things or teachings, if the core being is not taken care of, it just becomes a temporary patchwork. Like you might say, today, oh, my lover or my husband sent me a flower, I'm happy. Or my teacher smiled at me, I'm happy. But that's just for a temporary. See, we have, in a sense, I don't know, through the upbringing or whatever, we've lost the, sense of real being. I mean, this is something else that we can speak for many hours. But to see, the point what I'm trying to say is the trouble with us is we always identify ourselves with thought emotions.
When we have a negative thought, we think we're negative. When we have positive thoughts, we think we're positive. So we go yo-yo. The thoughts, I was really, they are always constantly changing, like the clouds. I remember once I was driving with a Tibetan Lama friend of mine. We were in Los Angeles airport. And we were going, and the person, I was dropping him at the airport, and then he was dropping me at the airport, and they were coming back, and the driver didn't quite know how to come back. So he was saying, okay, let's look at the cloud as a mark. So let's look at that as a cloud as a mark. I don't know if you got that one or not. But anyway, basically it means that if we rely on thoughts and emotions as a reference, you see, then it's not very reliable, isn't it?
No.
It's always constantly changing. And that is not really us. So then, what we are? What are we? What are we? This actually is rooted in the highest teaching of this Tibetan. In fact, initially, I felt a little bit hesitant to share this, but then Patrick Gaffney, who is my assistant, and he was really helped with the Tibetan book of the living and dying, he felt very much maybe I should share that with you. Also because of my past connection with you and so on. And it's because it's one of the most important points. So then I began to share this, which is that you see that beneath the all this, like, you know, like, for example, like, you know, like, remember I said earlier, you heard that, we are not the same when we are young, we are not the same when we are old, we are not the same this morning or tomorrow, for example. It's constantly changing. But beneath all that, there is a fundamental pure awareness that's always with us. Do you understand? That's with us when we're angry. That's with us when we're sad. That's with us when we're happy. You understand? They're always with us. That's fundamental, that awareness. The pure awareness. That pure awareness, unfortunately, because we've always been looking outwardly, we lost the sight of that. It's a bit like face. Even it's the closest to us, but we have no recognition. In the teaching said, because too close us, we don't see it. So that pure awareness, which is really our nature, the teaching point to us, is we lost the sight of that. Instead, we just go for thought emotions, its projections. And then that's where all the insecurity and all the problems come up, if I just put it very simply. So what the teaching is when you talk about samsara is mind turned outwardly, lost in its projection, but nirvana turned mind turned inwardly, recognizing nature, is when you turn your mind inwardly, instead of going with thoughts and emotions, with projections, you come to the root of the mind. You see? And that is, what is the root of mind? It's the fundamental pure awareness, this pristine pure awareness, which, as Shakespeare said, nothing is good or bad, thinking bad. So that aspect of pure mind, which is beyond good and bad, that crystal-like. You understand? Is that clear? That is what, when we do meditation at the highest level, particularly like when you say, just as water, if you don't stir it, become clear, mind left unaltered will find its true peace and well-being. Slowly when we do them, and thoughts, emotions, and all our arisings, when they kind of settle and dissolve, then what we find ourselves is in this pure, pristine awareness, where we find home, where we find the freedom. Is this clear? Is this clear? That is what we need to. In fact, in meditation, because real, you see, I think the meditation, because people think of meditation as, people think meditation as doing something, meditating on something. That is only the relative, because meditation has two aspects. There's the relative aspect, which is where the method is involved. But the way, the wisdom aspect, which is the more the revealing the ultimate nature. There's two aspects. There's wisdom aspect and there's method aspect. Method aspect, normally when people talk of meditation, they think it's on the method level, like meditating like on the breath, or like watching the breath, or thinking of a mantra, or visualizing an image, something like that. Even though that is meditation,
But this only a support, only to help to free the mind from its grasp. But then if you ask, what then is meditation? In its fundamental essence, that meditation is the state of non-distraction. You understand? The state of non-distraction. In the teaching called Mahamudra and the Dzogchen, which are the higher teaching in the Tibetan tradition, they speak of meditation as state of non-distraction. You understand? State of non-distraction, while not meditating on anything. Because when you remain in the state of non-distraction, then you come close to the state of Machupa, the unaltered. When you become the state of unaltered, the Machupa, you come closer and closer to the nature of your mind, the state of the pure, pristine awareness, which we can call it the enlightened mind. You understand? Which, when we come to that, free us. It's like when you bring the light, the darkness dissolves. For the darkness is merely an absence of light. That light is within ourselves. It is for us only to discover through meditation. And as we do so, then we have the liberation mind. And something amazing is that when you practice that way, the extraordinary impact of that is that all the fragmented aspect of us have come home. We become whole, negativity dissolves, and sometimes all the inner conflicts and struggles that we are, sometimes at war with ourselves, actually dissolve, and we become friends of ourselves, with ourselves. Is that clear? And what is amazing is that then we come into touch with ourselves, with our fundamental goodness. See, that all the barrier between us and us, ourselves dissolve. Not only that, barrier between us and others also dissolve. So then we are comfortable with others. We no longer are shy. We don't have to say sorry all the time. You know, England, you say sorry a lot. The timidity, the barrier between us. And then we become sincere. We become, how do you say, pure, genuine. Their motivation is pure. So there is no longer barrier. There is no suspicion. You see? And then actually then you feel well in your own skin. Like people always say, Dalai Lama, why are you so well in you? You know, then you become that. You become really well in your own being. You understand? You're well in your own skin. And then what is amazing is that really, then through this kind of practice, really, I remember one teacher used to say, a very great Tibetan teacher called Chögyam Trungpa. He used to say that the biggest problem in the West is speed and aggression. And through this kind of, the speed in terms of that always in a hurry, impatient, that kind of dissolves. And as Shakespeare called it, you can make haste slowly. There's a Tibetan saying, if you do slowly, slowly, you reach fast, fast. If you do slow, fast, fast, you reach slowly, slowly. And slowly, when you overcome the speed, and then also you come overcome frustration, the aggression, the violence. Because the violence comes from when you become frustrated, when you're impatient, when you know, so that it's to do with also space that you are in, the space of mind. It's always to do, we always think is the interaction with others, in fact. It's like when people don't love us or give us as we want, but fundamentally it's actually connecting with ourselves. When we're not well in ourselves, then actually if you're not well in yourself, you cannot possibly have a relationship. It's difficult to have a relationship. So that's why you understand that when you practice that way, it's a sense of an incredible wellness comes. Really. Sense of wellness. Physically, sense of wellness. In fact, there's one research said that when you're in the positive frame of mind, even all the cells in your body smile holding a little glass of champagne. Probably these are French cells. On the other hand, when you're negative, that even the cells become malignant. There is, because more and more research will show that like the negative or destructive emotions as toxic to health, as smoking or cholesterol is to heart disease. You see? So that's why very much you see that through this a sense of tremendous well-being. You see, I mean, for example, myself, sometimes I don't really need doctors or scientists to tell me. When I really practice, there's an incredible sense of well-being. And the whole of my body, my kind of psychophysical, whatever you call it, there's an incredible sense of balance, well-being, peace, and freedom, and wellness. You understand? And when you're in harmony with the world, you are in touch with the divine. The divinity is not outside, within ourselves. Then you become, I am who I am. That is the meaning of when Moses spoke. He said, I am who I am. I am who I am. Otherwise, it's a very rude answer. I got into a lot of trouble in India at a kind of a police border in this area of Himalayas in those days in early 1959. During there were a lot of spies. So the policeman asking me, who are you? I said, I am who I am. Where are you going? I'm going where I'm going. Where do you come from? I'm coming where I come from. So that's a very rude answer. I got a lot into trouble. But what is when God appeared to Moses is, I am who I am. He's speaking of this fundamental, pure, pristine awareness. You see? You know? And so that when we really experience this, then on the deeper level, all the negative emotions are freed. On the deeper level, negative. Because negative emotions are freed, then on the outer level, there's an incredible sense of well-being. On the physical, emotional, all that level. And then even on the outer level, all the conflicts resolve. Even the enemies begin to respect you. You no longer have quarrel with them. You get along with everybody. There is such benefit that comes from. And incredibly benefit for in terms of also one's health. And also when you become the transparency, you become genuine, authentic self, you become a good human being, and you connect with your good heart, your kindness, compassion, faith, devotion, all that exude from the state. To put it very simply. So, of course, then you see when we're not, well, I don't think we have no time to go into the more relative aspect of meditation because of the shortage of time. But since we have about 20 minutes or a little bit more, I thought maybe you can ask me questions. Well, there is one question here that I will try to answer. I suppose, Patrick, that's all right, isn't it? We didn't go through many of the problems. Do you think I should go through some? Yes. What is the purpose of mind, was the question. What is mind? That I answered it already, isn't it? Yeah. And what is the purpose of mind? Is to realize its true nature. In fact, the mind, you see, the human beings, we have the quality, see? We have the, in Tibetan saying, mashi tonko mitseng, that we can understand and we can communicate. That is the quality of human. The mind that we have is we can understand. We can understand the truth. We can realize the truth. This cognizant. But unfortunately, this cognizant, when it's misused, becomes the delusion. Anyway, I won't go into too much. The purpose of mind is to realize its true nature. To not to turn mind out would be lost and projected. But then also, please describe the state of consciousness and being after death. Is this question important or is it kind of irrelevant? It was long ago, it's changed. I think first of all, when you talk about consciousness, is as I said to you, mind is described as conscious, cognizant and awake. And when you talk about this, in the Buddhist teaching, we speak of what is called eight consciousness. Eight consciousness are the first five are related to the sense consciousness. Maybe I can just share that. Within the mind that we can speak of eight consciousness, eight divisions of eight consciousness. There are the five sensory consciousness,
which are based on five sense organs, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body. There are three mental consciousness, of which two are active, which is the sixth and the seventh, but one is inactive, which is the eighth, which is not active but not passive either. The sixth consciousness is the mind consciousness, an aspect of mind that cognizes and discerns. Whereas the seventh consciousness is the afflictive or the defiled mental consciousness, the ni-ni-ni-ni mind. No, ni-ni-ni-ni. The problematic mind, that's the word. So eighth consciousness is the ground of all consciousness. So how do we these consciousness work together? If you use the example of flower, the object, the flower, is seen by the means of eye consciousness, one of the five sensory consciousness. At the same moment the flower is seen, it is registered in the sixth consciousness. The sixth consciousness is simply knows, registers, that is a flower. It simply notices, understands, differentiates between information that is present to the five senses. That's a good one. But the problem comes the next instant as the seventh consciousness enters the process. Ordinarily, seventh consciousness is known as the conceptual, judgmental, and reactive mind. This is where our grasping rises and all the stories like, I like it, I want it, I don't like it, I don't want it, I'm indifferent, I don't care. It is this domain of ego in which all our various perceptions are evaluated in terms of I and mine. So the juncture between the sixth and seventh consciousness is where we have to watch out. Our problem is the gap between them is so short that we react too quickly, we jump to gun. Like sometimes like somebody's phone, you know, it's so charged that before it even rings, the answer machine comes on. Before we notice something, we immediately judged. So the point of meditation is to remain as long as possible in the sixth consciousness. That's why also in meditation, when thoughts, emotions rise, you simply see emotion as emotion, thought as thought. As one master put it, there's neither Jungian nor Freudian analysis involved. Thought cease to be VIPs in your life. You just simply see thought as thought, emotion of anger, oh anger, please sit there. Desire, oh please sit there. You know, you don't get involved. Main problem is ownership. Start owning. When you start owning, negative emotions may rise in the mind, but they have not yet become negative. It's when we start owning them, when we start reacting, then we make the karmic imprint. Is that clear? So that's the important thing is we need to create the space. The point of meditation is to remain as long as possible in the sixth consciousness in order to slow down the reaction of the seventh. This creates a more space between the sixth and seventh consciousness, which gives you the possibility of transformation and of wisdom. The seventh consciousness has a confused aspect, but also a liberating aspect, which means that it can either be deluded or undeluded. So if you can and re-educate the seven consciousness and develop an intelligent consciousness through the three wisdom tools of listening to the wisdom teachings, through contemplation, through meditation, then the seven consciousness can become an invitation to wisdom. And wisdom comes to play the storehouse of our mind, along with all its seeds, the karma. The inactive eight consciousness is cleansed and purified. So that's the very much about the and so. And yes, you were. Yes, please.
Thank you. You paint a most attractive picture of the Buddha nature dropping the ego and the enormous benefits to myself and everybody in the world from doing the practices of meditation that you. Is it possible in the last few minutes for you to give us a guided meditation,
okay,
showing us how the process happens and perhaps giving us an indication of how we can do that
good
when we leave this room.
Okay, I will try that, if you so wish. No? Please describe the state of consciousness and being after death. This is, whose question is this one? Somebody wrote it, there's a written question. Please describe the state of consciousness and being after death. Actually, afterwards, if you come and talk to me, okay, because of the shortage of time, I can tell you it's chapter 15,
16, 17, and 18. But I will also talk to you directly about it. And also, do we have a choice about being reborn again while we are in the Pardos? Yes, that's in chapter 18. And I would create, really, somebody asked that also, because of the shortage of time. And I think, since what you said, it seems the most important thing, you know? So perhaps we therefore go for that, shall we?
Yes.
Yeah.
And so therefore also our chairman is very happy that I remained within the time.
Now, let's use the same image, for example. As I said earlier, Chumanyok Natang. Now, the first thing is when you sit. Now, if you want to do meditation, then please sit upright. Okay? But sit as comfortable as you can. Okay? And just relax the mind. Just relax the mind. And you even don't worry about meditating. Don't think about it. And then keep your mouth slightly open as if you're about to say, but you don't have to say it. Just keep your mouth slightly open, if you so wish. Otherwise, if that's a problem, don't worry either. The reason for that is that sometimes in the highest Buddhist teachings, it speaks of that you should breathe through the mouth. Now, of course, again, about the meditation, more fuller, you know, the instruction or guidance is actually in chapter 5 in the Tibetan Book of Living. There. More detail is there, since we don't have time to go into detail. Is that main thing is that when you breathe through the mouth, it is said that normally we breathe through the nose, and that's great, said the karmic wind, the karmic prana, which give rise to a discursive thoughts. But when we just breathe more through the mouth, it is said, you know, then all the karmic winds which produce discursive thought dissolve into the central channel, into the avabhuti, giving rise to wisdom wind, the nature mind. Instead of thought, it gives to wisdom. So that's why sometimes it's good to just keep your mouth slightly open, breathe as you find quietly, not so much breathe through the nose, but slowly through the mouth. So you can breathe through the nose also, but, and that is if you choose. Otherwise also you can do as you please. You understand? Quietly. And then eyes, well, initially of course, very much you're used to meditating with your eyes closed, isn't it? But generally actually said in the teachings that first at the beginning you can keep your meditation with the eyes closed, but then slowly when your mind is settled, then you should slowly open your eyes. Because if you keep eyes closed for a long time, it slowly lead to this kind of meditation. I remember doing a number of ecumenical conferences where we had meditation sessions when our speaker and others just had a lovely, lovely snooze. And so anyway, you see, I mean, if you haven't just a good sleep, then that's fine. I mean, that's not meditation, put it this way. It's just a good snooze. So the eyes, you should slowly open, because eyes are also, on a more deeper level, eyes are the door of the wisdom. They're connected to the heart through the eyes. That's why if you look at the great masters in the Tibetan tradition, their gaze, the eyes are always in a very special way. Like sometimes you see great masters, when you just look at the face in the meditation, just looking at the face can produce the experience of meditation. And particularly the eyes. So the gaze are normally left unaltered. Just as we said, you know, just as water, if you don't stir it clear, in the same manner, you know, mind left unaltered. So the gaze is remain unaltered, like a clear lake unruffled by the wind. And then when there's a clear lake, all the stars and planets shine in that, like that. And also the body, it is said, should be like the mountain. Body like the mountain, leave it as it is. The gaze like the ocean, leave it as it is. Then just quietly. So, and here, since I'm not really introducing the meditation on the level of method, because on the level of method, which then you see, you use the, an object like the breath as an object of meditation and use it to more, how do you say, help your mind to not be distracted. But then really, that is only the initial level of meditation. But the real meditation is to go beyond the method and arrive at the state of non-distraction when you remain in the state of the unaltered nature mind. You know? Just quietly, let's sit there for a little while, shall we? And if you want it, you can just look at me during this meditation. If you just look at me and sit with me, and maybe this might inspire, might not. Just quietly let us see. In fact, just sit like me. See, just my level altered. Just as water, if you don't stir it, become clear. In the same manner, just mind left unaltered. Find its true peace. Just quietly let us see. Just quiet. For the moment, like for example, I'm not meditating on anything. But my mind is not distracted. In the state of just pure awareness. Quiet, resting. In the essence of mind. Mind turned not outwardly, lost in projection, but mind turned inwardly, recognizing in nature. There lies the nirvana. Now take a little break, just a few minutes, just a 30-second break, and this time sit with me with your eyes open. Try. You see, the key thing is just left unaltered. Allowing it just naturally, without any manipulation of thought and thinking, just allowing your mind just quietly be. Then what happens slowly, the thinking mind dissolves, thinking ego mind dissolves. Then your whole perception changes. Instead of thought becoming distraction, it's like the almost all distraction has been dissolved, like being sucked in, like the clouds have all been sucked by the clouds, by the sky. There's no longer any clouds like that. And then whatever rises is no longer any problem. That like sometimes when you see in the clear sky beautiful clouds, it's only ornament, thought only ornament. And what is amazing is when your mind is conquered that way, then what is amazing is that even though you see rising scum, but no longer there is grasping enter into your perception. Like sometimes I tell ladies, it's a bit like a non-stick pan. If you have a non-stick pan, you can fry, but it doesn't stick like that. Your mind becomes non-stick. Whatever rises, thoughts, emotions come, they do not stick. It's like even negative emotions come, it's a bit like it's almost happening to somebody else. And so if you leave things in their own risings, he just says, leave the rising in the rising. If you keep, then what happens is, they rise because of a reason. Because of their part of your, in your eight consciousness where all the karmic stores are. So that they rise because to be freed. But then in that process of freedom, we don't allow it to free. We grasp on it. We create further karma. So as we free ourselves that way, then gradually what happens is that, you see, mind becomes more free of all thoughts, you see. Even though the rising, it is said in the teachings, when you reach to that state of stability and peace, you see, that state of peace is not a stagnant state, stillness, but a very vibrant stillness where there is rising. But then when the rising happens, that you can recognize the risings. But yet there's an awareness, but yet at the same time, that the rising do not produce distraction, and you do not lose the ground of stillness. When you do this level, it's called one-pointedness. When the gap between stillness and movement dissolves. So then, in the stillness, there is a movement. In the movement, there is stillness. And that is how you enact in every day. You understand? without more and more mind is free of grasping. So when you look at things, your perceptions are very different. Just as I said earlier, when you conquer your mind, then your perception experience transforms. Thereby, even the appearance changes. So thereby, that when we are able to do that, then your whole perception changes. There is more peace. There's less entanglement. There's less emotionality. More wisdom. Is that clear? I think we've come exactly at 6:30. And so we stop there. And I hope that, I don't know what I've been able to share in within this short time. I spoke very freely, so I thought maybe that is better than presenting something on the paper. And I've thought some benefit may have come through this, I hope. And as Dalai Lama often says, if you find it very useful, something useful, then please practice it. Otherwise, forget about it. And also one thing is that, as Patrick was mentioning, or as an introduction, that we are presenting the teaching of this Buddhism, sharing this, but it's offered with no notion of conversion or excubity. In the openness of heart, so that people of any religion, any faith, or none at all can take it in order to enrich their lives. You understand? Very much. Particularly now the world has become so interdependent. So therefore, you know, we can learn from so many cultures, so many other wisdoms to enrich our lives, you know, to enrich. I think Western society is not going to be, after a while, not so much Western. It's already not so Western anyway. If there is the Japanese, all kinds of influences are there. So more and more these things will become. So anyway, so main thing is very much to really take care of your mind. If you don't look after yourself, nobody can look after you. Darlings.